Thanks for being here. First, I'd like to thank Gifre and Shelgun for organizing this conference. And today, I'm going to talk to you about directed influence and the RG flow. So this is work I've been doing with Gifre that I was planning to have uploaded to the archive before this talk, but it didn't quite happen. So I work in the same place as Kataev, so I've kind of learned that maybe publishing stuff is not so important. Well, and all of this work stems from a much earlier work I did with Gifre, and actually another postdoc is here now, Robert Pfeiffer. And this was sort of efficient algorithms to study boundary conformal field theories numerically. Okay, and so we wrote this, we had some proposal, we tried it, it worked really well. But it's only sort of much later that we've gone back and sort of tried to figure out exactly why it works and what is the full extent we can do with this. Okay, so I want to consider just what is essentially a very simple question. So if I have some extensive lattice, and I have two Hamiltonians on this lattice, or I have I'm considering, and these Hamiltonians are the same everywhere except, say, on some local region of the lattice. So I can write these two Hamiltonians, H and H tilde, as they're the same up to some addition of some term that's supported just on some local set of sites. And I want to pose the question, what can we say about the relationship between the ground states of these Hamiltonians that differ only on a local region? Is there some relationship we can get to? And of course, you can think of instances where this would be a very simple problem, particular if this Hamiltonian has a gap and this is sort of the strength of this term is sort of small compared to the gap, then things aren't going to change very much. It's a very simple problem we're dealing with. But of course, there are much more complicated instances. For instance, if this is a gapless Hamiltonian, then things become much more difficult. So an example of this, of course, is the Kondo impurity problem. So where we have a sort of 3D bulk of free fermions, and then we want to add see what happens when you add a local spin impurity to this problem. So in this case, the 3D bulk is very simple to describe. We know it exactly. But this problem of adding a local spin impurity was actually really difficult. And the reason for this is sort of, even if this is sort of some very weak coupling, because this bulk part is gapless, this very weak coupling can still be sort of very significant, and can still sort of drastically alter the low energy physics. So you can't just use your sort of usual perturbation theory to figure this out. And this particular problem was actually solved by Wilson, and he had to bring sort of much more complicated machinery to figure this out, including sort of formulating a version of real space renormalization group. And I'll be talking about that a bit later on. But another reason why you can think why sort of understanding this problem could be difficult is that a local change to the Hamiltonian can have, in a sense, a very delocalized effect on your ground state wave function. So imagine if we just have sort of a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and maybe on just one or two sites, we add a magnetic field. So if we have no magnetic field, then we have sort of no magnetization. But we just add a magnetic field on one site or two sites, and the magnetization now becomes non-zero everywhere in this lattice. So it has, so it decays back to zero sort of polynomially with distance from this impurity. But the main point is, this local change in this Hamiltonian sort of has some very delocalized effect on this ground state wave function. So my sort of motivation here today is to try and gain some understanding of how these two things, how ground states of Hamiltonians that differ only locally can relate to each other, some sort of conceptual understanding. At the same time, I also want to, at the end of the day, I also want efficient numerical algorithms to simulate, for instance, systems with impurities. So I'll just skip right ahead to the result. Okay, so I'm considering some D-dimensional Hamiltonian. And if I have some D plus one dimensional description of its ground state, so I'm considering a particular holographic description of the ground state. So here, the ground state is built and has some extra dimension, which we associate with an energy scale or a length scale. And the statement is that if I change my Hamiltonian on some local region, then in this D plus one dimensional holographic parameterization, this state only changes on some local region in here, some localized region. So that sort of bounded in space, but sort of goes through all of the energy scales. Okay, and this, and so, and what I will hopefully argue later is that this sort of localized change is precisely the right change to actually get these what look like very non-local changes in the ground state. Okay.
It doesn't spread in this
direction. It's in the appropriate measure. It's bounded in this width. Okay, so you probably have several questions at this point. So what is this holographic description I'm invoking here? And maybe also, so this is like, it looks like a nice sort of conceptual relationship, but is this actually useful for doing practical calculations? And of course, where does this come from? Why is this valid? So just to sketch the answers to these questions, so this holographic representation I'm considering is going to be a mirror, a multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. So this is a particular type of tensor network I'm considering. Is it useful? So this notion of directed influence is actually very, very useful for simulating systems with sort of homogeneous systems with local features that break translation invariance. And you can reduce sort of the number of parameters you need to encode such states from sort of order, at least sort of linear in the system size, to constant, so independent of the system size. And the validity of this statement sort of can be shown to sort of follow from Wilson's earlier renormalization ideas. Okay, so this sort of constitutes the outline of my talk. So first, I'm going to give a very quick introduction to the mirror, so I can't be pedagogical and explain everything here, but I just have to go skim over the details and discuss the applications of this concept to impurities, boundaries, and interfaces, and throw in a few numerical examples here. And then at the end, discuss why this is valid in the context of Wilson renormalization.
What if we say order one, is that order log n? Like one, roughly, not some for each layer?
I will consider mainly the scale invariant case. Well, the scale invariant case in which it's order one. You can do the infinite system directly. Yeah. Okay, so first of all, I'll just briefly introduce this real space renormalization procedure introduced by Giffray 7 or 8 years ago, called entanglement renormalization. So this is some concept for how I can coarse grain a lattice system. So I have my lattice of sites. So each site is some associated with some finite Hilbert space, and I'm going to sort of coarse grain this lattice into some new lattice. Implemented by these sort of local tensor transformations. So these squares represent unitary transformations acting on two sites. The triangles are isometric transformations that map three sites into a new site. Okay. So in particular, this transformation sort of maps a site, a block of three sites into a single site in this new coarse grain lattice. And these tensor transformations are constrained. The isometries W have isometric constraints, quite obviously. So W and W dagger, when I put them together, they annihilate to identity. And U dagger annihilate to two copies of the identity. So I can imagine if I have some local operator defined on L, this coarse graining transformation maps to a new operator on this coarser lattice. In particular, local operators map to local operators, and that follows from these constraints on the tensors. So when I do this transformation U, and if I put the U dagger here, then most of these local tensors will annihilate with their conjugates, and what's left is just something that locally acts on two sites. Okay. And of course, as an extension of this, if I have a Hamiltonian, which is the sum of some local terms, then if I coarse grain, so my Hamiltonian, I'm representing the sum of local terms is just all of these ovals here, so each one acts on two sites. And this coarse grains to a new Hamiltonian. And in particular, if I choose these tensors correctly, then this new Hamiltonian could be some low energy effective Hamiltonian for my original Hamiltonian.
Sorry, is there a particular reason you separate the sites into some of them you do the U-imperitonium and some of them you leave them?
It's just for technical reasons. It doesn't matter. You can do it in a number of ways. Yeah. In particular, and the reason why this particular type of transformation is useful is that it reproduces scale invariant Hamiltonians as fixed points. So if this is a scale invariant Hamiltonian, then it can be mapped into a copy of itself times some prefactor here. And this prefactor 1/3 relates to the fact I'm doing a 3-to-1 coarse graining with this.
So the choice of the U and W, does that always the same?
It's only under the proper choice of U and W that you get this. There's only sort of.
You get physically wrong result, make it a wrong choice, or.
Sure. Yeah. You get if you choose just say random tensors here, then you just get a nonsense Hamiltonian. It's not related to the original one in any way.
But that's some conditions.
So there are some conditions that you have to choose. You have to choose these to properly preserve the low energy part of your Hamiltonian.
Does it include also bond dimension properties?
And yeah, you have bond dimensions and stuff that I'm not going to talk about. So you can imagine if I did have, for instance, some scale invariant Hamiltonian on this lattice, I do my coarse graining, I get the same scale invariant Hamiltonian back. Well, I can sort of concatenate this and keep applying the same transformation many, many times. I mean, if this is an infinite lattice, I can go infinitely many times upwards. So this sort of sequence of concatenated renormalization transformations is what we call, in this case, a scale invariant mirror. Okay, so now this tensor network structure represents a state or a family of states on this lattice. Okay, and so there have been various sort of proposals for holographic interpretations of this. So Brian Swingle has done a lot of work on this, relating it potentially to concepts in ADS-CFT, and now many other people are looking at that as well. But one of the important aspects here is that this entire state on the infinite lattice is characterized by a single pair of tensors. So we have one. If I just tell you what these two local tensors are, you know everything about the state. So it's the same tensors repeated in translations, in space, and in scale. And so sometimes I'm too lazy to draw these tensors, so I will just represent a scale invariant mirror as something like this, where when you see this, you can just think this has some sort of fine structure of tensors that are the same tensors repeated everywhere. Yeah.
So you take the tensors at random, in general, there will not be any Hamiltonian, which is getting
If you take the tensors at random, they will not correspond to a ground state of a scale invariant Hamiltonian.
Yeah, the state will be scale invariant.
Up to some definition of scale invariant. It's not translation invariant, so I would be hesitant to say, to properly say that. And just one final thing before I actually move on to the interesting things. So this mirror has some inbuilt causal structure, and what this means, so for any sort of group of sites here, I can associate a causal cone, and what this is is it relates to the set of tensors that can affect the density matrix on these sites. Okay, so in this case, if I'm interested in computing a reduced density matrix for these two sites from the state, so I have the kit, and when I put the bra and trace out all of the other sites, then as we've seen sort of before when I was showing you the coarse graining, most of the tensors will end up annihilating with their conjugates, and it will only be sort of a very small part of the tensors that have any influence on what this density matrix is down here. In particular, by construction from the mirror, the causal cones have bounded width. And what this means, so the causal cone involves two indices here, sort of two indices here, two indices here, two indices here. It doesn't spread in the appropriate measure, which is number of indices in this case. So that was my very, very brief introduction to the mirror. So please, if you have detailed questions about this, you can come and see me. Now I move on to the more interesting sort of bits, is why, aside from sort of being some nice conceptual relation, is this useful? How is this useful? Just to simulation of many body systems, okay? So I have a mirror here. It's actually slightly different in its fine details. Don't worry about that. It's just a more convenient form to draw some pictures in this case. Okay, and so now the statement of directed influence is that if I have my mirror representing the ground state of this Hamiltonian, if I change the Hamiltonian on some local region, it's only the tensors within this causal cone that have to change in order to account for the presence of this impurity. And this is certainly not obvious or trivial. So I just showed you a definition of the causal cone and this definition related to computation of reduced density matrices. And here I'm considering something very different. I'm considering how the state changes in response to an impurity. And it just so happens to be that it's the same causal cone involved, but there's no sort of obvious or trivial relationship between these sort of two definitions of the causal cone. I think it's something sort of very, very deep that's happening there. Yeah.
So the Hamiltonian to be scale invariant, the scale scale invariant theory.
In this case, yeah.
And you have also tuned the defect. I guess
any impurity.
I mean, are the tensors
about
the same?
I will talk a bit more about that. In general, like, yes. So this is a very useful concept whenever the problem I'm interested in can be decomposed and sort of, so I have some extensive part that has symmetries, and then I have some local part that otherwise breaks the symmetries. These symmetries can be spatial symmetries, translation scale, and reflection invariance. They could be some sort of internal symmetries or degrees of freedom, so some sort of spin invariance. And the reason why this is useful is, so I want to find the ground state of H tilde. Well, first I find the ground state of the symmetric part, and this is much easier because I use my symmetries to get this ground state. And then once I have the ground state for the symmetric part, it's only sort of a very small change I have to make in order to get the ground state of H tilde. So in practice, imagine I have some homogeneous bulk Hamiltonian and the scale invariant mirror for it. So the scale invariant mirror has order one unique tensors, so just two unique tensors defining it. So now when I introduce an impurity, I only have to change what happens in this causal region. And what I'm going to do here is just throw away the tensors that were in there and just put some new tensors there for simplicity. So in a lot of cases, now my entire ground state is defined by just three unique tensors. So the bulk tensors I had before, and now these impurity tensors. So even though I'm describing a ground state on an infinite lattice system, and the state, this is not, we have broken translational invariance, but I can still describe the state with sort of order one unique tensors. And an answer to the previous question, so in most cases, I can choose these tensors to be the same tensors, or at least in the they will flow to some fixed tensor.
Okay.
So maybe I need one, or maybe I need a few to get that flow. Yeah. But it's still they go somewhere. Yeah. Okay. As a special case of the impurity, I can consider what happens if I choose my impurity to actually remove any interaction between the left and the right half of the chain. So in this case, I now have sort of a Hamiltonian for two open chains. So I know I don't have any entanglement between sort of this half and this half anymore. So I can sort of choose to set these tensors in the middle, these unitaries to identity in this case. Okay, so just remove them essentially. So now we have an ansatz for an open boundary system. And again, we just have a few unique tensors defining the bulk, and then just a single tensor, or maybe a couple of tensors on the boundary. And as another example, so imagine now I have two different bulks that are not interacting yet, and I have two different boundary mirrors representing the ground state of this open system and the ground state of this open system. Well, now if I add some coupling, I know I have to sort of change what happens in this causal region, and I just stitch these two wave functions together with a new tensor here. Okay, so again, I have this representation of this interface, which is not translation invariant, but I only have, it's only defined in terms of some small number of parameters. So I can, it's very nice that I can sort of glue these wave functions together in this way.
Sorry, I didn't get the statement. So is it like, in general, I only need to vary these tensors in the causal form, or is it special for the scaling?
The general statement is, the things outside of the causal cone can be left the same. And I'm explaining this mainly in terms of scale invariant mirror, but the principle actually can be argued more generally than that. But for right now, I'm just talking about scale invariant cases. These are the most interesting anyway, for me at least.
So is the evidence for that fact numerical, or do you actually have a more...
I can argue it later on. Okay, and of course, Y junction, I can have three bulks that I glue together at a junction of three wires. Many, many, many more games you can play along this line. So here is my schematic representation of what I was saying. So I have some bulk Hamiltonian, and I have some scale invariant mirror that where the local tensors have these sort of exploit the symmetries of the bulk. And then I use the same local tensors in here that have the same symmetries, even though the sort of the overall symmetry is broken by an impurity. Okay, and I think this is sort of some very nice conceptual picture between what's happening in this d-dimensional Hamiltonian and what's happening in this d plus one dimensional holographic representation of the ground state.
So if you compare this with an MPS, we know that an MPS couldn't accurately represent a scale invariant wave function. But if you thought of, say, something that wasn't, that had a gap and local growth, finite correlation length, then can you say anything sort of similar about changing, say, you know, one tensor to induce a boundary? Or?
I think you would have to change some finite region of tensors, and this finite region would depend on the correlation length. So this will become evident later on, actually. Okay, so just at this point, I think it's a good idea to give you some numerical evidence that what I'm saying is could be true. So imagine I'm considering just a very simple case. So a critical 1D icing chain. So the bulk interaction is just sigma x with a transverse field. And then at just one location, I'm changing this the the strength of the sigma-x interaction by some alpha. Okay, so this is my Hamiltonian, and I optimize this type of impurity mirror for its ground state. So this is sort of what I get. So this is a plot of the ground state magnetization as a function of sort of distance from the impurity. So as I make this alpha very small, then the magnetic field dominates and I get more magnetization. So the dots are numeric points and the lines are exact results. So everything there is correct, up to actually many digits. The energy associated to putting, so the difference in energy between my bulk state and my state with the impurity is some finite quantity that you can work out with the mirror, and it agrees with many digits to the exact result. Yeah. So these are sort of local properties of the state, but actually what's far more interesting is looking at how, so I had a critical theory and looking at how the introduction of this impurity changes the critical theory at the impurity. So what I'm looking at here is the dimension of the scaling operators. So the operators that transform self-similarly at this impurity. So this is sort of function of the impurity strength and how the scaling dimensions change. And again, these are numeric data with the lines are the exact results known from conformal field theory. Okay, so what we can see is that even in these sort of two limits, so alpha equals zero and alpha equals infinity, so this is either an infinitely weak impurity or an infinitely strong impurity, we're still getting correct results very accurately. So it's not as though we're just sort of considering a perturbation here, where we can be very brutal and put sort of an infinitely strong impurity and it still works out. We still recover the correct conformal data sort of over this whole range. Again, a related example. So now what happens if I consider, rather than just changing the XX at one position, maybe I change it at two positions. So I have two impurities. So here is the causal cone of these in the mirror, which fuses into a single causal cone at some distance. And what this relates to is that as I sort of coarse grain these impurities, as I go to sort of longer and longer length scales, eventually I'm not going to see two impurities. I'm going to see sort of some single effective impurity there. And so we can ask the question, given I have two impurities, what is the effective impurity I'm going to see? Sort of how do these two impurities fuse? And so we have a result from CFT that tells us if I sort of choose opposite impurities, so a weak link here and a strong link here, according to some criteria, then these two impurities will essentially cancel each other out and I'll get the identity back. So we can try and check this numerically with the mirror. So first of all, here is just some plot of the magnetization. So each of the red lines just represents what happens when you just have one of the impurities, and the black dots are the magnetization profile for when both impurities are present. Again, we plot the scaling dimensions. So the scaling dimension is associated to when you just have one impurity, the scaling dimension is associated to the second impurity. And now we look at the conformal theory that happens when both these impurities fuse together. And what we see is that these are precisely the bulk scaling dimensions of the icing model. So these represent no impurity. So these numerical results sort of confirm that the two opposite impurities cancel each other out, or coarse grain is a sort of no impurity again. Okay, I've shown you just some applications of what you can do with this sort of concept of directed influence. And it's very useful for describing states, homogeneous states with local features that break translation invariance. So in particular, the number of parameters you need to represent these states can be reduced from at least linear in the system size is going to cost you to order one, to constant. So you can study the thermodynamic limit directly, despite the broken translation invariance. And you can get sort of short range properties of these systems accurately, which is which these are sort of quite easy to get with a number of approaches. But you can also get these long-range properties of ground states, the correlators, this, the conformal data, this sort of asymptotically long-distance, low-energy behavior. And this is typically much harder to get with other approaches. And of course, as I said before, we're not limited to perturbations. We can add sort of arbitrarily strong things there, and it still seems to work. And I have a number of similar results for other types of systems and other models that maybe I will also put online at one day.
Can you help classify the interfaces between two profoundly theories?
I probably not. No. Well,
I mean, maybe. Not classify them all, but you search for them because I'm trying to say.
I wouldn't know how to do this offhand, or I wouldn't even know what you mean by this. Maybe we can discuss after.
For example, this visualizing, you had a continuum spectrum of interfaces, but this is quite exceptional. Mm-hmm. So in general, you have a discrete set of objects.
You can try and explore, for given models, you can try and explore.
You have a finite space of this entanglement, of this central tensor, right?
I don't know a good way to explore all possibilities offhand for what you can have at this interface.
When you go from one level to the next, isn't there some sort of function of?
Sorry. Keep going. Good. Okay. So in the final part of the talk, I'll try and convince you or try and explain where this concept comes from. So why do I only have to change a small subset of my state in order to account for an impurity in the Hamiltonian? Okay, so back to Wilson. So there was the Kondo impurity problem, which is a 3D bulk of free fermions with a magnetic impurity. So Wilson, in his solution to this problem, derived an effective 1D Hamiltonian for this system. So the details of how we went from this 3D bulk to this 1D effective Hamiltonian are not relevant here. I'm not going to talk about that. What is relevant is how he solved this effective 1D problem. So this effective 1D problem on a semi-infinite lattice has a form where it has an identical local coupling between each site, but the coefficient, the magnitude of this coupling decreases as you go further away from the boundary. So this alpha is greater than one. So this is a very strong coupling between the two sites, a weaker coupling, and so forth. And so Wilson developed what he called numerical renormalization group as a way to attack this problem, as basically some sort of iterative block diagonalization. Okay, so how does this work? Well, at the first step, I mean, this is kind of, it seems very intuitive that, so I have some dominant interaction, some dominant coupling, and I can consider sort of everything else as some sort of perturbation of this. So this is some much weaker interaction. So according to, so just sort of standard perturbation theory, I'm going to sort of address this dominant coupling. So diagonalize this block of the Hamiltonian, And I'm only going to keep the low energy part of this the eigenvectors of this block. So I throw away everything else on this block. So in particular, I can construct an isometry from the span of these low energy eigenvectors on this block. Okay. So I construct this isometry, and then I apply it to my Hamiltonian to truncate degrees of freedom. So now sort of this whole thing represents some sort of effective lower energy Hamiltonian for the original. So I've combined sort of these two sites into one and done some truncation. And now, of course, I can play this game again where I look at this block and consider everything else as a perturbation of this block.
So in practice, you're throwing away the smallest eigenvalue for the reduced density matrix?
No, we're throwing away the high energy eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. We don't need the density matrix in this case. Okay. And again, we keep playing this game where we sort of diagonalize a block and then apply these isometries to truncate the high energy degrees of freedom on this block. Okay, and if we keep doing this, sort of eventually what we can get or what we can interpret, so we can interpret these isometries, we get that truncate degrees of freedom as a matrix product representation of the ground state of this chain. Okay, so is that clear to people? I don't think I don't think MPS was introduced earlier. I was kind of counting on that. But this collection of tensors is a matrix product state. Yeah, if you don't take my word for it. So now we can ask the question. So if I have this representation of the ground state of this Hamiltonian, if I change the Hamiltonian just on some local region, how is it going to change the ground state? Can we say anything about this? And it turns out, yes, we can by construction of this approach. So these tensors we obtained here sort of only depended on the block Hamiltonian coming before it. So when I go to sort of find this tensor by diagonalizing this block, of course, this tensor cares about this impurity of Poitier, and sort of all of the rest of the tensors that follow it also care about it. But in practice, we have this notion of influence in the Wilson chain. And so I say the Wilson chain is 0 plus 1 dimensions because we have one dimension, but it's associated to a change in energy rather than a spatial dimension. Okay, so we have this notion of influence in the Wilson chain that when I represent the ground state as an MPS, if I change my Hamiltonian locally, only some of the tensors in the MPS have to change in order to account for this. And so I have a direction of strong influence and a direction of weak influence. And within the NRG framework, this is negligible. You just ignore this completely. But this property is not an intrinsic property of matrix product states themselves. This results from the fact that we have well-defined energy scales in this problem, that sort of these tensors parameterize higher energy and these ones parameterize lower energy scales. Okay, so if we didn't have this well-defined energy scales, then you have influence in both directions. So you would need to, as Steve was discussing earlier, you would need to sort of change a whole range of these tensors in order to account for just a local change in the Hamiltonian. So the idea going from NRG to MERA it's a very similar idea. So I like to think of this as sort of the 0 plus 1 dimensional, and this is exactly the same concept, but in D plus 1 dimensions. So within this Wilson problem, these different energy scales were explicit in the problem. But here with the MERA, it's sort of intrinsic to the coarse grading. So we start from some sort of homogeneous Hamiltonian, and each layer of this MERA represents a coarse grading transformation that takes us to some sort of lower energy scale. So so we have this intrinsic flow from UB to IR, where here it was explicit in the Hamiltonian itself. And just to give you some intuition for why this concept of directed influence works, well, I change my Hamiltonian locally. It has some strong sort of influence on all of the tensors at lower energy scales. So everything in this causal cone. But you can see sort of the influence points into the causal cone, so it doesn't escape outwards. Okay, so it's a similar concept. And in fact, in our paper, we actually make this. This is not just a hand-wavy argument. We actually make this very precise, in that you can show these two things are exactly the same. I'll just give you a very quick sketch of why that is. So I have my MERA and my Hamiltonian. And what I'm going to do is just look at what happens in one causal cone here. What I mean by that is So this is a sketch. So these tensors represent sort of just the tensors in the causal cone. And this Hamiltonian represents some effective Hamiltonian I get by sort of, I can map this Hamiltonian to some Hamiltonian that lives on the surface of this causal cone. And we can do this mapping in our framework. And in particular, what we can show is that if this Hamiltonian is scale invariant, then this effective Hamiltonian for the surface of the causal cone is exactly this Wilson chain Hamiltonian. So we have our mirror that's been changed. So we introduce an impurity and we change the tensors in our mirror just within this causal region. And now I want to argue that I'm justified in leaving the tensors outside of here unchanged, okay? And the justification is actually very simple. So I'm looking at this causal cone of this red dashed region. So in changing from here to here, this block Hamiltonian that lives on the surface of this causal cone has only changed at sort of higher energy, at lower energy scales, higher depths in the mirror. So this part of the block Hamiltonian only depends on sort of what's happening locally around this region. So the justification for why I'm allowed to leave these tensors unchanged from the previous ones is exactly this Wilson argument for why I was allowed to do this with numerical renormalization group. Okay, so I think at least in certain cases, so this argument directly, if this is true, then it directly implies that this is also true. Okay, so just to summarize, so I propose some sort of, so if I have Hamiltonian and some holographic description of the ground state, that the local change in the Hamiltonian corresponds to some kind of localized change in this holographic description of the ground state that sort of is bounded in width but propagates through all the energy scales. So I think this is sort of some very conceptually appealing way of understanding how changes in the Hamiltonian, local changes, affects the ground state. It's also sort of exposed some causal structure in the holographic geometry that I don't think has been sort of discussed before. And as I discussed at length, this concept is very useful for making numeric algorithms to simulate many-body systems. You can get much more efficient simulations than you would otherwise. And I hope I've managed to justify this in terms of sort of a well-established principle there. Thank you.
Any questions? So this scale invariant Hamiltonian, is there a systematic way to construct them?
Systematic way to construct?
Means like, is there like, I write down an equation and then I find solution to the equation which gives me different scale invariant Hamiltonian with different center charge?
No, we can't. This would be very nice if we could work backwards from the mirror and figure out what scale invariant Hamiltonians there are, but for technical reasons, we don't seem to be able to do that.
So how do you numerically find the fixed point of the mirror? Is that how you find it?
I mean, you give me a Hamiltonian, I go away and do the numerics to find the mirror. that's the way we do things.
Minimizing energy.
Minimizing energy, yeah. Miles?
When you gave the example of the Wilson chain, you showed that there's like strong influence going one way mm-hmm. and there's weak influence going the other way, but it's not like no influence, right? So
it's,
how do you...
It's not, yeah, you're very correct. It's not no influence. Mm-hmm. So you could in this case, or depending on the size of this alpha, you could get a better result by maybe changing this one also, or this one. Mm-hmm. So you could take sort of account of this weak influence if you want. And the same thing with the mirror, you could sort of have some sort of thickness around this causal cone to give you better results. In practice, we find we don't actually need to do this. This just taking this, just neglecting this weak influence directly seems to work really well.
Sorry.
you shoehorn Mira on a non-scaled invariant Hamiltonian, what happens?
If you put this
scale
invariant Mira
there? Hamiltonian adjacent scale invariant.
Yeah.
Do you try to put Mira on it?
If you just optimize a mirror, then you won't get a scale invariant mirror.
Well, you mean only if you can.
Well, okay. If you try and optimize a scale invariant mirror, so you enforce scale invariants in the mirror.
Is it just garbage, or is it some sort of?
Well, you will get the best approximation to the state from a scale invariant state, maybe. I don't know whether.
Well, I mean, I just wonder if you've done any of these tests where you have maybe a near scale invariant Hamiltonian. So the perturbations of that, where you're not sure if it's scale invariant, for instance.
This can be a sort of a way to try and find where the critical point is, where it becomes scale invariant by imposing scale invariance and then seeing where it works.
Like the wrongness of the assumption?
Sure. I mean, you optimize the scale invariant mirror, and then you relax the constraint that is scale invariant, and you can see how much it changes, and that tells you how far away from scale invariance you are.
You also see that the scaling dimensions don't make sense. For instance, you don't have the scaling dimension corresponding to a Hamiltonian.
Can I ask you to comment a little bit more on this difference between in the actual kind of numerical method, truncating Hilbert space based on the energy versus truncating it based on?
Sure, that's a very good question. So this procedure developed by Wilson for building an MPS this way, this is only justified in the case that you have these different energy scales. If these were all the same strength coupling, then this wouldn't work. So this was actually Steve White's, one of his greatest contributions was saying that in the case where all of these are the same magnitude, I need some extra information to decide how to truncate this space. It's not okay just to truncate based on the Hamiltonian. And he figured out the best way to truncate is by looking at the reduced density matrix on this block. But here, because I have these energy scales, just looking at the Hamiltonian actually works pretty well.
There's no... Thank you.